Connect to 526-5738 or go to
KPFT FM HD2, Houston.
Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM HD2, Houston's community media. We discuss local, state, national, and international stories that may have slipped under your radar. My co-host, collaborator, editor, and occasional counterfoil, as well as assistant producer, is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
You know, usual gab, be registered to vote. No vote, no elections coming up, at least over the next few days, in case they surprise me. Always remember to apply for a mail-in ballot if you are eligible. It must be snail mail. You can't do it online. Okay, from communityimpact.com. Tomball to begin enforcing hotel occupancy tax collection from short-term rentals. Now, I've had some discussions on this. I think a short-term rental is anything like 6 months to me is a short-term rental. Anything under that I would consider ultra-short-term. But what do I know? I am not the law. Okay, so the story starts. Tomball will be, and this is from communityimpact.com. Tomball will begin enforcing hotel occupancy tax, or HOT, H-O-T, from short-term rental properties, according to Finance Director Catherine Tapscott, who gave a presentation on the topic to City Council at its June 19th meeting. At this time, she said, we're not seeking to require any regulatory compliance or licensing for short-term rentals. I consider that a mistake. We're just wanting to collect that hotel occupancy tax. I guess regulation costs money. Tax is income. Anyway, the city's vendor for collecting HOT, called Avenue, will identify short-term rentals within Tomball, collect the tax, and monitor for new short-term rental properties, Tapscott said. Avenue will monitor over 80 websites to stay on top of new short-term rental property listings in Tomball, according to a presentation from the company. Tomball collects a 7% HOT, HOT tax, which is actually redundant. But anyway, hotel occupancy tax following the adoption of an ordinance in 2006, Tapscott said. The city defines short-term as less than 30 days, according to Tapscott's presentation. Tomball collects HOT from 10 hotels or motels and one bed and breakfast facility, Tapscott said. The city also receives HOT from several short-term rental properties, but the collection wasn't being enforced. There are 93 active short-term rental properties in Tomball with an average nightly rate of $236.54, according to Avenue's presentation. At a 40% occupancy rate, the estimated HOT revenue is about $250,000 for Tomball. According to its presentation, Avenue will discover and identify potential short-term rental properties, obtain proof that a property is a short-term rental, communicate with a short-term rental property about HOT compliance, and recover funds from the newly discovered short-term rental properties. There's a little more to the story. Personally, I'm glad that Tomball will be evening the playing field a bit between hotels, motels, and what I'm generically going to call Airbnb-type rentals. I've thought a lot about the various ways that people are driven into barely affordable rentals and even homelessness. The first time my eyes were opened to this some years ago was on a visit to Kauai in Hawaii. That was the first time I was introduced emphatically to the term houseless. They would not let me use the term homeless. In Kauai, it wasn't used as generically as it is now. It meant more specifically a person that had a job, but the job didn't pay enough to rent a place to live, let alone buy a place. The island was full of mostly empty timeshares, but rentable apartments were scarce and costly. In Houston and other places around the U.S., housing structures aren't necessarily scarce, but timeshares, Airbnb types, and massively corporate-owned rentals are all contributing to the problem of rental availability and homeownership. That Tomball is finally starting to treat so-called short-term rentals more equally to motels and hotels by finally taxing them the way the law has always specified is a good thing. It's unfortunate that they will not be regulated and licensed. Making short-term rentals fully compliant with their traditional competitors might even change the economics and put some housing back on the market. Andrew?
Well, I really didn't have any comments on this one because we're on basically the exact same wavelength. I agree with everything you've said.
Love the Venn diagram when it works. Okay, from communityimpact.com, Harris County jurors will get a pay boost starting September. Residents and registered voters serving jury duty from across Harris County will get a pay bump starting in September after the Texas legislature approved the first pay increase in the state since 2005, according to Harris County officials. Governor Greg Abbott signed House Bill 3474 that calls for jury pay to increase from $6 to $20 for the first day. Hey, man, that's over 300% pay increase. And from $40 to $58 on subsequent days that you serve on the jury. Harris County District Clerk Marilyn Burgess, whose office oversees the jury summons and court process, said in a statement that she traveled to Austin several times this year in order to push for passage of a jury pay increase for Texas jurors. Burgess said, "I'm confident this jury pay increase is a necessary first step towards improving participation and having juries that reflect the diverse racial and socioeconomic demographics of Harris County. We can only achieve that if we pay our jurors fairly." Burgess went before Harris County Commissioner's Court in March of 2021 with a proposal to increase jury pay, according to a news release. She proposed a higher rate than what was approved by the governor in June of 2023 to go from $6 for the first day to $50, 50, and from $40 for subsequent days to $80 for subsequent days. But Commissioner's Court tabled the proposal. "More," she said, "is needed in terms of jury pay, and I will continue to work with Commissioner's Court to supplement the local portion of jury pay in Harris County," Burgess said. "Personally, I always found a jury pay of $6 a day to be kind of insulting. It really was just enough to pay for the special jury parking rate of $6. I couldn't believe that they raised it to $6 a day in 2005. I mean, $6 per day? That hasn't been good pay since the 1920s, and it was exactly what I had to pay for parking, so I felt like the fix was in. I realized that jury duty is a civic responsibility, and there was a time in my life when I would have looked forward to serving, but even drafted soldiers get paid plus room and board. By the way, you have to buy your own coffee and sandwiches when you're serving jury duty. That eats up $6 pretty quickly. So $20 for the first day, which for many people is often not longer than 4 hours if you're not called to a panel, at least starts to cover commuting expenses and feels like your service is maybe a little valued. Paying jurors $58 a day on subsequent service days, again, is not a lot in the scheme of things, but at least makes your service feel valued. Maybe the next thing they should do is index juror pay to inflation, because in 5 years, there will be significant erosion in the value of this pay boost, and we'll pretty much be back in real dollars in terms of where we are now." Andrew?
Well, I'm interested in serving on a jury, just to have the experience, but I do think that if the state is serious about wanting most people to not resent jury duty, or at least resent it less, the pay rate really should match minimum hourly wage. Since you might have to take time off work for it, that's time that you're not spending on earning your normal wage. And even $20 for the first day might not be enough to avoid jurors taking a financial hit that month. The other option is to require employers to give paid time off for jury service instead of just unpaid time off, and only compensate unemployed jurors, which could save the state a lot of money. But somehow, I don't think the anti-spending angle is going to override the pro-business angle of Texas Republicans. Yeah,
and we haven't even really gotten to self-employed jurors.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Which can be like a whole other thing. Well, I've been self-employed, so for me, it's a top-of-mind issue. But, yeah, I mean, if you want people to serve on a jury and not look at it as a burden to be escaped, like dodging the draft, I think something approximating fair pay probably is the way to go.
Yeah.
Okay, our next story from CommunityImpact.com. ERCOT cannot be sued over the 2021 winter storm, court rules. The Electric Reliability Council of Texas, ERCOT, which operates the state power grid, is immune to lawsuits over grid issues during the 2021 winter storm, the Texas Supreme Court ruled on June 23rd. And I have decided to call them Scott, the Supreme Court of Texas. So, Scott. Scott determined that ERCOT is a government entity, making it immune to lawsuits. According to Chief Justice Nathan L. Hecht, ERCOT's governmental nature is demonstrated most prominently by the level of control and authority the state exercises over it and its accountability to the state. Of course, I could argue I have those same things. The court ruled unanimously that ERCOT is part of the government, granting it some immunity, but it split 5-4 on whether it was eligible for sovereign immunity. Justices dismissed two lawsuits, one from San Antonio's municipal utility provider CPS Energy, and the other from Panda Power Funds, a private power plant developer based near Dallas. Separate from the storm, Panda Power requested $2 billion to alleviate substantial financial harm caused by inaccurate demand reports from ERCOT. ERCOT serves 90% of Texas's population and 75% of its land. Hecht wrote that granting immunity, quote, prevents the disruption of key governmental services, protects public funds, and respects separation of powers principles. Justices Jeff Boyd and John Philip Devine wrote in a dissenting opinion that unlike other entities previously granted immunity by this court, no statute designates ERCOT as a part of the government. The dissenting judges recommended that the Texas legislature correct the court's error by removing some or all of ERCOT's immunity through future legislation. In this way, the dissent said, the legislature could begin restoring the public's trust following the court's erroneous extension of sovereign immunity to a purely private corporation. In a statement, ERCOT applauded the court's decision and emphasized that the ruling, quote, allows us to continue to focus on our core state responsibilities on ensuring a reliable grid for Texans. I don't think I'll be taking any of Andrew's information by saying that Andrew looked it up and ERCOT is a 501c4, which means that monies that it takes in are not tax deductible, which presumably means that ERCOT is taxable. Because if you can't deduct it, typically that means they're taxed.
Yep. Although, I think when we looked this up, there was...
it's a nonprofit. It's an industrial nonprofit that contributions to it, membership fees more or less, are not tax deductible. But typically when something cannot be deducted from taxes... someone has to pay taxes.
Well,
unless they're a church.
There is a way for 501c4s to also, you know, be tax exempt. So I don't remember all the details. Actually, I have it open in another tab. Let me
Something about social services, about that.
The income tax exception for the this is from Wikipedia, the free encyclopedia that anyone can edit. The income tax exemption for 501c4 organizations applies to most of their operations, but income spent on political activities, generally the advocacy of a particular candidate in an election, is taxable, right? Okay. Yes, and yeah, that's about all it says there. Let's see, hang on. Contributions are not tax deductible, right? Unless the organization is a volunteer fire department or a veterans organization. Interesting to know. Dues may be deductible as a business expense, although amounts paid for intervention or participation in politics are not. Let's see.
That takes some CPAs to parse out.
Well, I figure it's probably somewhat intended that way. Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's about all it says. So,
well, let me just, if I may resume, yes. I had in my last line that this ruling allows ERCOT, us is the quote, allows us to continue to focus on our core state responsibilities on ensuring a reliable grid for Texans. And my initial comment on that was I didn't really have to include that last sentence from ERCOT's statement, except that it tickled my darker sense of humor. I'm somewhat familiar with sovereign immunity. At its core, it means that you can't sue the government unless they allow you to and give you permission. But this immunity that the Texas Supreme Court, or SCOT, has carved out seems dubious at best. See, ERCOT is immune, but it's not sovereign immune, according to this ruling. I'm unclear how that works. Not having read the actual opinion, it's 53 pages, I think that the opinions of dissenters on the court that will ultimately stand the test of time is this bit. No statute designates ERCOT as a part of the government, according to Justices Boyd and Devine in their dissent. The dissenting opinion is linked in the above quote. I think it explains itself in the first 9 pages, the opinion that is, which are light reading and plain English, double-spaced with wide margins. It's pretty painless and explains itself clearly. The Scott precedent should not be allowed to stand, in my opinion. By the way, I like calling it Scott. It's like you have SCOTUS, you have Scott. Andrew?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think if we can call ERCOT ERCOT, I don't see why we can't call Scott Scott. Name games aside, though, I can see the value in trying to avoid a sudden legal meltdown of the state's electricity manager. With things the way they are over there, a big lawsuit might also mean outages, or at least impediments to service. But extending this immunity to ERCOT not only sets a dangerous precedent that virtually any private organization acting on behalf of the state of Texas can have immunity extended to it, it also prevents the people directly harmed by ERCOT's mismanagement during the big freeze from getting any financial restitution. This is about the only consequence that would matter for ERCOT, since it operates in the interest of for-profit power companies who fund it through membership dues. Any legal settlements would eat into that dues money, so they'd want to avoid them. This case was about some electric companies trying to seek damages, but I'm sure that this result will also be trotted out should any individuals themselves try to get justice. To sum up, I can see the motivation behind this ruling, but the implications don't justify it, and it should absolutely be overturned by a future court or by the legislature.
Yeah, not having been privy to the actual legal arguments, I think the fact that it is a nonprofit industry advocacy organization.
Yeah.
And this is basically two power companies suing this nonprofit industry advocacy organization. I personally have a feeling that if they really wanted to push, well, I guess the Texas Supreme Court, as far as you can go, I just can't see how they can justify any kind of a sovereign immunity.
Yeah, I mean, I will say.
Immunity under the color of being sovereign.
Yeah, I will say that ERCOT does do more than just be an advocacy organization for the industry. They do actually manage the Texas interconnection, which is our grid. But like they do that because otherwise the companies themselves would have to do it. So,
and also they take some direction from the state. But, you know, if you're going to use that as an excuse for immunity, doesn't everybody take some direction from the state?
Right. It's just there's just no leg to stand on really
no.
for this ruling, except the ones that the majority made up. So,
right. Yeah, they made up a leg. Okay, you are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM, HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central and repeating Thursdays at 6 p.m. You can also hear the show online from anywhere in the world at kpft.org by downloading it with Google Podcasts, available from either Android or the iPhone app stores, by visiting archive.kpft.org for previous episodes of this show and up to 100 other KPFT programs. We typically heavily excerpt every story, so I do link to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Click the show links, show posts, and more tab at the top of the webpage and find the post for the show or show date you're looking for, and recent shows are near the top. Shows and articles go back to May 2010 on the website, so you can type in keywords into the search bar and you never know what you'll turn up. We're on social media for questions, comments, and suggestions. Check our Facebook page at ThinkWing Radio with Mike Honig, and look for me on Twitter at ThinkWing Radio. And also keep in mind that while we don't do transcripts per se, about 80 or 90% of the show is scripted, so you can just scan down the blog post to find what you're interested in. And Andrew has his accounts.
I sure do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on Twitch, where I play games, talk socialist politics, and make stupid jokes. That's Dominate, E-Y-E, on Twitter, Tumblr, and Twitch.
Okay, from TheGuardian.com, under the heading, I think it should be, The Cruelty is the Point. Texas governor signs bill rescinding water breaks. That's water workers' water breaks as deadly heat grips state. Amid a dangerous heat wave that has brought blistering temperatures across Texas, the state's governor signed a law this week eliminating local rules requiring water breaks for workers. The measure, which will take effect later this year, will nullify ordinances enacted by Austin and Dallas that mandate 10-minute breaks for construction workers every 4 hours. My understanding is the Department of Labor mandates 10-minute breaks every 4 hours, but neither here nor there. It also prevents any other local governments from passing similar worker protections because Republicans are the small government party. Just days after Greg Abbott, the governor, ratified the law, officials said a 35-year-old utility lineman working to restore power in Marshall, Texas, died after experiencing symptoms of heat illness. The heat index, which takes into account both temperature and humidity, was 100 degrees Fahrenheit, 37 degrees centigrade, while he was working. It was an omen of what could come after HB 2127 takes effect in December, wrote the Texas branch of the AFL-CIO union, referring to the far-reaching law that not only curbs cities' rights to enact worker protections, but a number of labor, agriculture, natural resources, and finance measures. Banning required rest breaks for construction workers in Texas heat is deadly, they said. The law's passage has enraged workers' advocates who warned that it will result in even more heat-related deaths and illnesses in a state that already tallies the highest number of worker deaths due to high temperatures. 6 out of every 10 construction workers in Texas are Latino, and labor advocates say that the law will hurt Latino and Black communities that are already disproportionately affected by extreme heat. Hispanic workers made up a third of all worker heat deaths since 2010, according to an NPR Columbia study. The local protections are crucial, advocates say, because the Federal Occupation Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, does not have a national heat protection standard. Still, the Republican lawmakers pushing the new law have said it eliminates a, quote, hodgepodge of onerous and burdensome regulations. I'm sorry, I had to drip that with sarcasm, that Texas businesses face. The effort aims to prevent cities and counties from enacting progressive policies that counter the state Republican supermajority's aims. For too long, progressive municipal officials and agencies have made Texas small businesses jump through contradictory and confusing hoops, said Republican State Representative Dustin Burroughs, who introduced the bill. After the state's second hottest summer on record last year, Democratic legislators introduced bills that would have set heat illness guidelines for Texas businesses and required mandatory breaks for government contractors, but those efforts failed to advance. Such protections are crucial, advocates say, as the climate crisis brings hotter, more prolonged heat waves. In Texas, the number of triple-digit temperature days have nearly doubled over the past 45 years, the state report found. David Cruz, the communications director for League of United Latin American Citizens, or LULAC, a Latino civil rights group, said it is striking that Republican officials want to override local protections that cost businesses just 20 minutes of their workers' productivity per day to protect against catastrophic illness and death. He said, we have to take a stand on what is humane. So my observation is, here's another example of today's Republican Party. It fashions itself as the small government, freedom, and liberty party, and here the small government party is forbidding small local governments from protecting their outdoor workers from global warming-induced climate change that can cause death. The rules being overridden don't require shade for workers or cool down areas. The rule is just a 10-minute break every 4 hours for water. Frankly, even those two breaks are barely helpful. I looked up a military document called Water Requirements and Soldier Hydration. So this is what the U.S. military believes someone working outdoors in heat requires. It provides detailed descriptions of the hydration needs of soldiers under various conditions. On the PDF page 30, it's broken down in part like this. A soldier's daily water requirements increase as a function of the total calories expended per day, because sweat losses are dependent on exercise intensity and duration of effort. For example, in temperate conditions, moderate intensity military tasks will elicit sweating rates of approximately 0.3 liters per hour, whereas hard work will elicit sweating rates of approximately 0.7 liters per hour. The duration of physical activity also has a significant effect on water need. Although moderate intensity work in temperate conditions might not elicit high rates of sweating, when extended over an 8-hour period, a soldier's daily fluid requirements, and I think this is what we're talking about here in outdoor local work, increases the body's fluid requirements to an additional 2.4 liters per day. 2.4 liters, that's a little over half a gallon. I might add, over half a gallon of water per day, in addition to the 0.3 liters per hour or the 0.7 liters per hour. So I'm left wondering if Governor Abbott or anyone in the Texas legislature, and by the way, that document is backed up by a lot of scientific specificity. I wonder if Governor Abbott or anyone in the Texas legislature, while in their air-conditioned offices and legislative chambers with water coolers close at hand, thought to consult a document like this with its empirical measurements of human exertions and consequent hydration needs. But the modern Republican Party is the party of interference in local government, relaxation of child labor laws, denial of Medicaid to the poor and indigent, and distaste for Social Security and Medicare and other regressive and oppressive beliefs. As I often say, elections have consequences. Make sure you vote in every election and vote these bums out. Andrew?
You know, this is exactly the kind of situation that will only be improved by workers themselves. There are no laws to provide even token protection on this front anymore. If workers don't want to die from heat stroke, they're going to have to take water, rest, and shade breaks without anyone's permission. If company policy doesn't like this, workers are going to have to force those policies to change. This is called direct action, and it's the best way to make positive changes at work, and the only viable way when the law doesn't have your back. One way workers can ensure that they still get their breaks would be to coordinate so that everyone takes a break at the same time, the old logic of they can't fire us all. There are other tactics workers can use if management tries to crack down, reducing productivity by doing exactly what the boss says and nothing more, intentionally working at a slower pace, intentionally making mistakes, or making demands by marching on the boss or striking. These tactics are all examples of direct action. I'm part of a group that teaches workers to use direct action to win their demands. It's called the Industrial Workers of the World. Their website is IWW.org, and there are branches of Houston, Austin, and North Texas, linked all on the blog at thinkwingradio.com. I think, or at least I hope, that we will hear a lot more instances. We'll hear about a lot more instances of workers using direct action to protect both their health and their right to protect their health in the absence of laws that do it for them. Those laws are great when they exist, but they can always be repealed by lawmakers who don't care about workplace safety. But when workers care and coordinate, they can always take action to guarantee safety themselves.
You know, an effective protest might be a die-in for these kinds of workers. And,
yeah.
And the cool thing about it is that some of the workers might end up not being able to get up at the end of the die-in, which would sort of enforce the point. Not that I'm wishing it on anybody, but, you know, a die-in, at least they get a chance to rest.
Well, you know, there were a series...
You know, even in slave plantations, didn't there used to be a slave who would go along the rows and give the slaves some sips of water while they worked?
I don't remember anything like that, but it wouldn't surprise me. But I can tell you what I do know. There actually were protests back in the 1990s, I think, before the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act or a threat to it or something like that, led by disabled people. And they were called die-ins. Maybe those were called...
Anti-war demonstrations were mostly die-ins.
And there were AIDS protests as well by the LGBT yes. community called die-ins as well. Yes. I'm maybe conflating a lot of protests, but...
There are a lot of protests to conflate, which I may guess, be part yeah. of the problem.
Well, and maybe part of the point is...
I mean, part of the problem is that there are so many things to protest, if I may clarify.
But part of the point as well is that, you know, these kinds of... obstructive protests are the ones that stick in people's minds, right? And these are the ones that people look to draw inspiration from. These are the ones that matter. And so, yeah, taking this kind of action and, you know, standing in the way of the progress of whatever it is that's keeping you down, yeah, an important
okay. thing. I think we're ready for a break. This is Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM, HD2, Houston's Community Media. Airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central and re-airing Thursdays at 6 p.m. You can also hear it live online anywhere in the world at kpft.org. You can download Google Podcasts from either the Android or iPhone app stores and listen that way, which I recommend. You can also go to archive.kpft.org for previous editions of this show and the almost 100 show titles that KPFT's Houston Media broadcasts every week. To do that, though, we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied homegrown programming. You can show your support for Think Wing Radio and KPFT by going to kpft.org and hitting the donate button. All donations are tax deductible. Pick your favorite show, we would appreciate ours, and the amount of your donation, whether large, small, or in between. Maybe even a continuing donation, a sustainer. And you may qualify for a lovely thank you gift, just ask. And tell people about KPFT and your favorite shows, because spreading the word helps us too, and it's free. Okay, next story is from the Washington Post. 2 years after the Surfside condominium collapse, a bitter feud over the oceanfront land. On a lot scarred by the memories of 98 people who died here 2 years ago, developers are hopeful a new luxury oceanfront 12-story condominium building could soon rise. The building, designed by a world-renowned architectural firm, will be constructed of glass fiber reinforced concrete and partially inspired by one of South Florida's most recognizable skyscrapers. As described by Dubai-based DAMAC, perhaps DAMAC International, 57 homeowners will live in a building that includes, quote, soft cloud-like elements and facade that echoes the colors and textures of sand, unquote, as it stands over a pristine beach. But as the replacement for the Champlain Towers South condominium building progresses, the project is caught up in a bitterly personal debate over whether the 1.8-acre lot should also include space for a memorial to those killed in one of the nation's most horrific building failures. Nearly 2 years ago, the condo collapsed as most residents were asleep in their beds, leading to an anguishing search and rescue mission and eventually demolition of what was left standing. To family members who believe tiny remnants of their loved ones could still be lying undetected in crevices around the site, as well as in the ocean breezes that sweep across it each day, the proposal for a new building is the latest insult in a flawed and rushed redevelopment project. To truly honor the dead, they say, the millionaires who will call the building home should have to share the high-priced strip of land with those who never got a chance to leave the location on January 24th, 2021. I lost my sister and my brother-in-law, and we received just 1% of my brother-in-law's body and 33% of my sister's body, said Martin Langesfeld, who was referring to his sister Nicole and her husband Louis Sadovnik. We worked together and incorporate a memorial on the site, and they can still build their ultra-luxurious apartments, but we don't build over dead bodies in America. I know that's the line that caught me, which is why I stopped there. Andrew, your turn.
Well, this is absolutely ghoulish. They want to build luxury condos for millionaires on the site of a collapse of a middle-class condo building? It reads like the world's most obvious allegory for capitalism, but it's actually happening. The memorial is the least they can do. There is no moral or ethical grounds for the developers to say no here. But if the developers cared about morals or ethics, they'd have said yes. I hope no construction company will take the project until a memorial is also in the plans. That, and maybe local protests, are about the only ways I can think of to force the developers to comply with the wishes of the victims' families. On a side note, I want to mention that unfortunately we do build over dead bodies in the U.S., both figuratively with this country's history of slavery and genocide of indigenous peoples, and literally when construction projects find human remains. I wish Mr. Lenkesfeld was right, but unfortunately his pain has a lot of precedent.
You know, the entire property, according to the article, is 1.8 acres. Mm. And the families are asking for 0.44 acres, which is not a tiny chunk of that property, but which could be, a green space with memorial trees, memorial benches. I mean, there are a lot of ways it can do it that it might actually enhance the property.
Yeah.
But I was also struck by the last part of the story that I excerpted, which is why I ended it there. We don't build over dead bodies in America is kind of what stopped me in my tracks. First, a little background on this story, or at least a little context. In the Orthodox Jewish tradition, and perhaps in Islam as well, there is a belief that all parts of a person need to be buried. You don't want to leave any of it out in the open for birds or insects or rot. In Israel, there are Orthodox religious teams that scour an area for all parts of a dead victim, including blood as much as possible, so the individuals can get a complete burial. I imagine that's at least part of what's at work among the families and friends here. There is, you know, even for the unreligious, there is cultural carryover. Plus that in some cases, so little in the way of remains was found. I mean, 1%, that could be a finger. That's just terrible to contemplate. But that part about not building over graves in America is just historically wrong. It happens more often over Black and Native American graves, but cemeteries and graveyards are abandoned and forgotten often over the centuries. Let's remember Richard III was found buried under a parking lot in the UK.
Yep. And there's an example right here at home. I think Central Park was built over a Black cemetery.
It was built over a Black community. I don't know if there was a cemetery there.
Ah.
But in any case, maybe half right. But that part about not building over graves in America is just wrong. Ultimately, this is an emotional issue. Even if the religious part is an emotional issue, the dead are indifferent. Funerals and memorial services are for the living rather than the dead. To put this in a little different context, the catacombs of Paris were quarries converted to ossuaries or bone storage, essentially. Quoting from the cited link, preparation work began shortly after a 1774 series of basement wall collapses around the Holy Innocents Cemetery added a sense of urgency to the cemetery eliminating measure. And from 1786, nightly processions of covered wagons transferred remains from most of Paris's cemeteries to a mine shaft opened near, pronunciation forgiveness requested, Rue de la Tombe Issoire. By the time the catacombs were built, burials were mostly taking place outside of Paris. The living relatives of those who were moved were long gone. There's an expression, in 100 years, who will care? Well, right now, the living still care. For the next part of the show, I am going to do something unusual. I am not excerpting an article because there's too much uncertainty about what happened in Russia over the weekend and what the short, medium, and long-term consequences and outcomes will be. If you're the type of person that listens to this show, you have probably heard about the military mutiny or coup attempt or whatever they end up calling it that occurred in Russia over the weekend. The Wagner Group, owned and run by Putin's chef, Yevgeny Prigozhin, literally turned on Moscow over the weekend until he literally turned around from Moscow and is now in Belarus. What this all means for Prigozhin, Wagner, Belarus, Ukraine, NATO, and last but not least, Putin and Russia is still the stuff of armchair prognostication. Could Putin and Prigozhin still make a deal and have Wagner make a surprise raid into Ukraine's north? Could Belarus's President Lukashenko suddenly find himself a player in European geopolitics with a ruthless mercenary army in his borders. There are innumerable possibilities and permutations, but I would suggest that Yevgeny Prigozhin stay away from rooftops and upper story windows if he knows what's good for him. Andrew?
Well, I have also been paying attention to the news of the Wagner group, rather, turning on Russia, and I can't say I was surprised. In general, mercenaries are out for themselves first. When the client is paying fine and the job is reasonable, looking out for themselves means completing the contract and getting repeat business. But when that falls apart, they can use whatever force they want against whoever they want to recoup their investment. There can be exceptions, like if a group's founder is a member of a marginalized community and is explicitly trying to protect other marginalized people. But that's not common. The profit-driven potential for betrayal is probably the biggest practical reason for governments not to use mercenary groups. Varying ethical standards is a less practical reason, but more important. Unfortunately, the U.S. government has used mercenaries before and allowed them to operate in this country. The most infamous example is probably the Pinkertons. Having been contracted for various U.S. government operations before agencies like the FBI existed, the Pinkertons were also responsible for brutally cracking down on labor organizing. The federal government did distance themselves from the company, as well as mercenaries in general, with the Anti-Pinkerton Act of 1893, but the company still exists and operates in the U.S. today. It's not the only one. Blackwater, now known as Constellis, mostly does work for the CIA and State Department in foreign nations, but their headquarters are located in Virginia. This is something of a trend. Even if a company mostly does work outside of the U.S., they still maintain domestic corporate presences, and the federal government often still hires them. That U.S. presence, though, does open the door to further regulation, possibly even a hardline stance against traditionally structured for-profit companies like these, and an effort to investigate their employees for domestic or international crimes. I would hope that the Wagner Group incident will prompt fresh scrutiny around whether these kinds of companies should be allowed to exist in the U.S., much less work for the government. But I suspect that the combination of lobbying, cynicism, and a preference for the status quo in politics will prove a difficult wall to scale for anyone wanting to push this conversation in a meaningful direction.
It's worth noting that Blackwater was formed by Eric Prince, the brother of Trump's Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos. Now, Blackwater is currently called Academy with an I, although sporting goods is probably a theme, kind of a bitter irony. Now, until Andrew mentioned it, I had never heard specifically of the Anti-Pinkerton Act, so I looked it up. Wikipedia did really little more than just report on it. So I looked further, and the U.S. Government Accountability Office was a little more helpful, and I take this bit of excerpt. A company whose corporate charter specifically authorized investigative as well as protective functions, and which was licensed as a detective agency, was a detective agency for purposes of the Anti-Pinkerton Act and may not be employed by the federal government. In other words, it seems that you can be a detective agency or a protective agency, but not work for the U.S. government as both if you purport to be a detective agency. So this is probably why they divided up into detective agencies and security agencies. Now, Western nations would do well to be reminded by the Wagner Group rebellion attempt in Russia that mercenaries are self-employed, with loyalty only to their current employers. Mercenary organizations like the Wagner Group are literal double-edged swords. Russia was just reminded of this. Mercenaries are not good for democracies either, and this is absolutely why the U.S. and other democracies should not use independent contractors, a.k.a. mercenaries, nor allow them to develop armies on their territories. Sadly, this does not seem to prevent the U.S. government from hiring mercenaries. Of course, the U.S. government and most other governments don't call them that anymore. They're called private military contractors, and their leaders aren't warlords, they're CEOs. It's all a very semantic difference. The incentives for hiring private military contractors are their political distance from governments, the plausible deniability for war crimes, the avoidance of public backlash for sending our boys into dubious wars, and, of course, the substantial back-end savings and veterans benefits. Blackwater's Eric Prince proposed to Trump at one time that the war in Afghanistan should be entirely privatized. Blackwater would fight it more cheaply, permit withdrawal of U.S. troops, and allow extraction of valuable minerals by U.S. companies in the process, possibly allowing the U.S. to turn a profit on the war. Fortunately, maybe even a little surprisingly, Trump turned down this proposal. But the use of mercenary troops is addictive, corrosive, and dangerous to both democracies and autocracies. Just ask Rome how that ultimately worked out for them. Their mercenaries, and they used them for a long time, insisted upon more and more money and concessions from the empire, and eventually turned on Rome when their payments could not meet the mercenaries' demands. You perhaps have heard of the sacking of Rome in 454 AD. Hey, Andrew, as far as you know, is Academy, nay, Blackwater, still a contractor for the U.S. government?
Well, I couldn't get a straight confirmation, because, of course, but based on the present tense used in all of the relevant research I could pull up, I think they are still contracting for the federal government, yes.
So, what might distinguish the difference between a military contractor and a security contractor? Maybe heavy weapons could be the red line. There are lots of firearms that are legal to own in the U.S., but medium and heavy weapons like rocket launchers and tanks and large bombs are beyond the pale, and maybe that's the difference between a security contractor and a mercenary military force. Maybe this is something that can be addressed legislatively in the future.
I do like that line as a sort of technocratic boundary, because, yeah, especially if you're talking about addressing this legislatively, you're going to need some hard line to be able to say, you know, this company falls on this side of it, this company falls on the other side of it. So, yeah, I think a heavy weapon, you know, usage or stockpile is, yeah, that could work as a very strong indicator.
Yeah, basically, if you're doing bodyguard work, you probably don't need a Leopard 2 tank.
Yeah.
Just out of curiosity for those who wonder, the Wagner Group, was it named after the composer? Apparently, yes. The group reportedly took its name from the nom de guerre of its leader, Dmitry Utkin, a retired Russian military officer, who was said to have chosen Wagner to honor the composer who was a favorite of Hitler's. So you already know the really sweetheart guys that are involved in this. Okay, you are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. and re-airing Thursdays at 6 p.m. You can also hear the show live online from anywhere in the world at kpft.org. Download it with Google Podcasts, which is available from Android and iPhone app stores, or by visiting archive.kpft.org for previous versions of this show and almost 100 other KPFT programs. We heavily excerpt almost every story on the show, which is why we include links to the full articles and, by the way, what's close to a transcript in a script, on show posts and more at Think Wing Radio. You can also visit kpft.org to find out what's new at the station. They do update it periodically. You can catch up on your favorite shows on the archive. And this is important, you can help KPFT keep the lights on by clicking the donate button. You can also donate by calling KPFT at 713-526-5738, extension 1. That's 713-526-5738, extension 1. You can send us your thoughts about our show by emailing thinkwingradio@msn.com. We can also take comments on Facebook at ThinkWing Radio with Mike Koenig. I am still occasionally on Twitter at ThinkWing Radio, plus Andrew has his accounts.
I sure do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on Twitch, where I, when I'm in the mood for it, play games, talk socialist politics, and make stupid jokes. That's DominateEYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and Twitch.
Okay, we had a story that didn't make it into the show last week. It now sort of raises an observation. What a difference a week can make. And I wonder what this story would have looked like today as opposed to, say, last Friday. I've edited it down some more to take out some extraneous, but here's how it begins. Now, this took place on Saturday, June 17th.
What's the title of it? Who's it from?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Putin. Good call. It's from Reuters. Putin rebuts key elements of African peace plan for Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin on Saturday gave African leaders seeking to mediate the war in Ukraine a list of reasons why he believed many of their proposals were misguided, pouring cold water on a plan already largely dismissed by Kyiv. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said after meeting them in Kyiv on Friday that peace talks would require Moscow to withdraw its forces from occupied Ukrainian territory, something Russia has said is not negotiable. Putin opened Saturday's talks with representatives of Senegal, Egypt, Zambia, Uganda, the Congo Republic, Comoros, and South Africa in a palace near St. Petersburg by stressing Russia's commitment to the continent. But after presentations from Comoran, Senegalese, and South African presidents, Putin stepped in to challenge the assumptions of the plan, predicated on acceptance of internationally recognized borders before the round of statements could go any further. Putin reiterated his position that Ukraine and its Western allies had started the conflict long before Russia sent its armed forces over the border in February last year, something that the West denies. He said the West, not Russia, was responsible for a sharp rise in global food prices last year that has hit Africa especially hard. And he said Russia had never refused talks with the Ukrainian side, which had been blocked by Kyiv. Moscow has, however, repeatedly said any peace must allow for, quote, new realities, unquote, meaning its declared annexation of five Ukrainian provinces, four of which it only partially controls, and a red line for Kyiv. Peskov said that Putin had shown interest in the plan, whose 10 points South African President Cyril Ramaphosa laid out in his presentation, and Russia would continue dialogue with the African countries. Now, this is last week's story, and I'm going to add a little of this week's post-Wagner commentary. After the scary week Putin just had with a heavily armed mercenary military force about 125 miles from Moscow, one can only wonder how this meeting might have looked this week rather than last. I got the sense that Putin came off as kind of arrogant in this story. If this meeting had been conducted now, I'm certain that Putin would not have wanted to look weak, but might have sounded a little more receptive. The situation in Moscow around Putin is still probably pretty fluid. When you've grown up only knowing Putin as leading Russia, these sorts of things often seem unchangeable until they suddenly change. We are living through interesting times. Footnote, boredom is a highly underrated commodity. Andrew?
Well, I definitely think Putin will be a little bit more accommodating of the African peace plan today than he was last week. Back then, he believed he was in a strong enough position to set the assumptions of the plan. The Wagner Group's reversal has shaken that, I bet. However, I think Zelensky was the missing piece last week and still is. I think the priority should be stopping further bloodshed. If Putin wants to negotiate, he needs to get Zelensky to the table. In order to do that, Putin will have to agree to withdraw at least some Russian troops, troops that undoubtedly got redeployed and shaken around when the Wagner Group incident happened. Some may already be able to be considered withdrawn, and who knows if the Wagner troops are in any shape to rejoin the fighting in Ukraine after their stunt. It could be strategically easier for Putin to comply with the Zelensky's conditions right now. If he has to hedge his bets, he might even be able to take the opportunity to resupply the troops he withdraws, because the troops that have been redeployed are probably already resupplying anyway. If I were advising Putin, I would be strongly suggesting he pivot his rhetoric about this invasion. Make it about liberating the separatist regions of Donetsk and Luhansk. Get Ukraine to agree to let those regions break away in exchange for Russian troops withdrawing from all other occupied Ukrainian territory, including Crimea. He could sell the whole invasion to the Russian people as a strategic move to aid friendly liberation movements, something about self-determination, stop hemorrhaging troops and materials, and get some sanctions lifted. Ukraine could get Crimea back and have a win against Russia under its belt. Everybody gains. But I fear that such an outcome would require this war being just about territory and not ideology. For Russia, I think this war is about Russian nationalism and chauvinism. For Ukraine, I think it's about not losing their country, which, fair, but also about proving their mettle against Russia. I think these ideological motivations are what really stand in the way of finding a peaceful and maybe even just way of stopping this bloodshed.
It's worth noting I read recently that Ukraine is currently considered the most heavily armed country in Europe.
Wow, that's...
that's a thing.
Yeah, that's like a...
I mean, it makes sense. They're in the middle of mobilizing for war, and, you know, but
Yeah, it absolutely does. But it's a very real and very quick summary, I guess, of how this war has upended so much.
And it may end up being that the European nations may very well want to help Ukraine maintain that strength as essentially their bulwark against any further Russian aggression, assuming Russia can be pushed back.
That would be a hell of a thing for Putin to have stumbled into.
It's kind of like Sweden joining NATO and Finland joining NATO. And it's like all of a sudden forward troop movements into previously relatively unmilitarized NATO countries.
Yeah. Things that didn't, it hadn't happened yet before the war.
He precipitated them.
Yeah. He was trying to stop them from happening with this war, but instead he caused them to happen. So
he was like wrong way Putin, running the ball to the wrong goal. Okay, there was one story that hit my mailbox at about 7:04 this morning, Wednesday morning, and I'm not going to read you the story, although it's interesting, but the title caught me. Analysis: Age of Crisis Leaves World's Big Currencies Out of Sync. Now, I was telling Andrew, the term Battle of the Bulge was not a military term that developed. That was actually taken from a news story that caught on. And I think to call the era we're living through right now as the age of crisis, I think that hits it. I think that's the nail on the head right there. So
yeah,
the Cold War to the age of crisis. And I think that Alan John and Dara Rana Singh should get credit for that. It's perfect.
It's a very succinct, a very fitting, and a very apt name for the past few years I think we found ourselves in, not just the Ukrainian war, but with COVID, with like the Ever Given, all these sorts of things, these big disruptions to the world economy, I would say.
But age of crisis, when you talk about bipolar powers turning into tripolar powers and regional powers suddenly getting stronger and everyone sort of feeling their oats to see where they can manipulate the game, and nuclear weapons and technology kind of spreading. And yeah, we are living in an age of crisis. That is what I am calling it from now on. Okay, you've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on Houston's Community Media, KPFT 90.1 FM HD2. My co-host, indispensable editor, partner in the creation of this show, assistant producer, and much obliged for all his work, editor is Andrew Ferguson. Thank you, Andrew, for all you do and all the tolerance you put into my screwy hours. And we hope the listeners have enjoyed the show, gotten something from the show, and we hope we'll have you back with us next week. Y'all take care.
See you later.
Can't you see the morning? It's waiting right outside the storm. Why don't we cross the bridge together and find the place that's safe and warm? It's not too late. We should be giving.
Mama, what does the chicken say?
Chicken. Oh, okay.
And a wolf?
Oh, a wolf. Ooh!
What about the tiny dog? Cat. Owl.
Ooh, ooh, ooh.
Dolphin? What does the turkey say? Whale.
Whale sound.
Do the giraffe.
Giraffe, really? Okay. Giraffe.
You're not going to get it all right. Just make sure you nail the big stuff, like making sure your kids are buckled correctly in the right seat for their age and size. Get it right.
Visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat.
Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
KPFT Artist Profile, Glenna Bell.
Hey, everybody. This is Glenna Bell. I'm here at the KPFT Studios. Beautiful brand new building here on Caroline. So excited to be here. So I've been asked to talk just for a second about what I love about KPFT. Not only that they play my music, but I'm a listener. I listen to KPFT every day. And there are just so many great shows, shows from the past that I've always enjoyed, and a bunch of new shows that are coming out for the future. So I hope everybody will tune in and continue to tune in and support our local community radio, because it's true, there really is nothing else like it. This is only in Houston. KPFT.